KQED. From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. In for Scott Schaefer, I'm Catherine Barron. Coming up, voters who decline to state their party affiliation could be the election day life of the party. Also, cows, or more precisely, cow waste, could be an answer to the Central Valley's dual energy and pollution troubles.
This really is not a cow pie in the sky solution, as I call it. They're actually doing this in Sweden.
And Air Force One lands on display at the Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley.
When you're on it, you sort of think, wow, you know, I'm one of 50 people flying with the President of the United States.
Those stories, plus how a decade of financial ups and downs has changed the state's business and economic landscape. It's the California Report. The airwaves and mailboxes are full of messages urging you to vote in the special election November 8th, now just a little more than 2 weeks away. And both the governor's supporters and opponents are actively targeting a group of voters that are either split on their loyalties or just disenchanted with party politics altogether. Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers reports.
Even in California, which has a rich history of third-party politics, the conventional wisdom used to be when one major party lost members, the other major party gained members. But in recent years, the California Democratic and Republican parties have both lost members at the same time, with more and more voters checking a box on their registration form that says they decline to state a party preference. Mark Baldessari is director of polling for the Public Policy Institute of California.
Among Californians, we find a lot of people who not only distrust government, but distrust the party system. And for them, they wear the title of decline to state with honor.
Statewide registration figures released last month show a record 18% of registered voters now decline to state a party preference. That's up from a little more than 12% of registered voters in 1998. Decline to state voters in California are hard to categorize, according to pollsters and political scientists. Some are young voters who never firmly attached to a political party. Some are more fiscally conservative than most California Democrats. Others are more socially liberal than most California Republicans. But their power is undeniable. In 2002, decline to state voters helped Gray Davis win the job of governor. In 2003, they helped kick him out of the job and elect Arnold Schwarzenegger. And in 2004, they largely backed John Kerry over Schwarzenegger's choice for president, George Bush. All of this makes decline to state voters a key part of the campaign over the eight initiatives on the November ballot. And both sides think they've got the upper hand. Todd Harris is a spokesman for the governor's campaign team.
Someone who declines to pick a party identification inherently is not happy with the status quo, and therefore we view them as a ripe target audience for the governor's reform message.
But Democrats argue Schwarzenegger has miscalculated by asking independent voters to simply trust him and vote yes on an entire package of proposals. Gail Kaufman, chief strategist for the campaign against Schwarzenegger's measures, says her focus groups have found decline to state voters want more details, not fewer.
A number of people in our group say, I want to hear from both sides. I don't want you to assume that I always believe just one party or the other. And I want to hear from both. And I know if I'm a decline to state voters, I'm going to hear from both.
And that has led both major campaigns to target decline to state voters with specific mailers, even specific phone calls, urging either a yes or no vote. But with decline to state voters so hard to pin down on any one viewpoint, both sides may not know if their strategy worked until election night. For the California Report, I'm John Myers in Sacramento.
President Bush returned to California this week to raise money and to attend the unveiling of the new Air Force One exhibit at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley. Air Force One, tail number 27,000, is the actual plane that carried every president from Richard Nixon to the current commander-in-chief. KPCC reporter Steve Julian got a preview.
Melissa Giller walks briskly down the long, narrow hallway connecting the library to its newest attraction. It's clear that the library spokeswoman wants this experience to have all the emotional pull of, well, a certain Orange County theme park.
As you look down the colonnade, you can actually see the nose of Air Force One. We call it our castle effect. If you go to Disneyland, you see the castle and it sort of draws you down Main Street. And here Air Force One sort of draws you down the colonnade into the pavilion.
But instead of Sleeping Beauty, we're greeted by the sounds of construction as we head into the huge building that's as big as a hangar, a word you don't want to use here.
We don't consider this a hangar by any means. We do consider this a pavilion.
The Air Force One Pavilion. The plane, a Boeing 707, painted its original white, navy blue, and aquamarine, stands before a 60 by 200-foot wall of glass overlooking Ventura County Hills. It's propped on concrete columns at a 2% up-tilt to give the illusion that it's taking off. What strikes you when you board the plane is how modest and cramped it is for a presidential transport. One hallway is only 16 inches wide, and most everything remains accessible.
You can't walk into the cockpit, but you can lean in, and you can see all the knobs and the buttons and the lights and the chairs.
And they're all active, too.
They're
it's
all
powered.
Active. In fact, it actually works. I mean, it doesn't fly, but...
Giller says another Air Force One plane that's on exhibit in Ohio has plexiglass to keep out curious hands. She says her team made a conscious decision not to do that because President Reagan wanted tours at his library to be a very personal experience. In fact, Joanne Drake says it was Reagan who began the effort to get the plane. Drake was Reagan's senior trip advisor during his second term and chief of staff during the last 9 years of his life.
He knew when he left Washington that this was where he wanted the airplane. And when it became available, we told him about it. He did know that it was coming here. Of course, he didn't know all the details, but I feel confident he does now, certainly.
The U.S. Air Force Museum, which owns the jet, has it on permanent loan to the Reagan Library. Drake remembers taking a half dozen trips aboard Air Force One.
Being on board is truly an experience that I think when you're on it, you sort of think, wow, you know, I'm one of 50 people flying with the President of the United States.
Once you enter the plane in its pavilion, you can poke your head into the cockpit. You then head down the corridor, past the front galley and communications bank, until you suddenly find yourself looking into the president's cabin. Two leather seats facing each other. One seatbelt has the presidential seal. The first lady's cabin is through an open door, and library spokeswoman Melissa Giller points to the lack of luxury.
You can see her flight jacket. The pillows and the blanket, if she was to take a little rest, that's where she would do it. Again, no beds, not even a futon-type couch. It's just a normal couch.
The library's hope is that the new exhibit will attract a broader base of visitors, including those interested in aviation. Drake says she thinks even jaded D.C. types will come to see it.
They see the airplane all the time fly over, the helicopter fly over. But even those people, they're dying to get on board.
Also on display in the Air Force One Pavilion is Lyndon Johnson's green and white Marine One helicopter and Secret Service cars. Next to the gift shop, the library also has constructed a pub that President Reagan visited during a 1984 trip to Ireland, and it's not a replica. The owners actually donated the interior of the shuttered bar. On one wall is a large photo of the late president hoisting a beer. For the California Report, I'm Steve Julian.
California's Central Valley is home to some of the richest farmland in the country and some of the dirtiest air. Businesses and community leaders are gathering next week in Fresno to discuss solutions. One idea is getting support from an unusual alliance, dairy owners and environmentalists. From the Central Valley Bureau, Sasha Coca reports.
California is home to more than 1.5 million dairy cows, and each of them produce about 120 pounds of waste a day. They're also the number one source of smog-making gases in the Central Valley, where most of the state's dairies are clustered. But now researchers are proposing a solution that could tackle emissions from cows, and in the process, also tackle emissions from cars. They want to use gas from dairy manure to fuel vehicles. They got the idea by looking at some California dairies which are relying on biomethane to create electricity. Here at Joseph Gallo Farms near Atwater, a system known as a methane digester is used to power the machines in the cheese plant. This system was built with a grant from the California Energy Commission.
We're big believers in cow power here.
That's Carl Morris, general manager of the Gallo Cheese Plant.
We like the idea of making electricity out of manure instead of paying PG&E.
Believe it or not, it's not very hard to convert cow waste to electricity. Cows eat in a line along a fence. Their waste is then flushed down a channel behind them. Most of the solid waste is separated out by a giant sifting machine. The remaining liquid is sent to a lagoon. There, a specially engineered plastic cover traps the methane gas that's formed by naturally occurring bacteria in the water. Once the gas is cleaned of harmful pollutants, the end result is a clear, odorless gas, similar to what comes out of a kitchen stove. Biomethane burned at the Gallo cheese plant generates 700 kilowatts of electricity. That's about 60% of what the cheese plant needs to operate. Gas from cows is used to run the machines that separate the curds and whey, form the cheese into blocks, and then slice it and seal it in packages. Researchers say if it's good enough to power a cheese plant, it's good enough to power a car. Alan DeSalt is an energy consultant with a San Francisco organization called Sustainable Conservation and the author of a new report promoting biogas as fuel.
This really is not a cow pie in the sky solution, as I call it. They're actually doing this in Sweden.
Sweden produces methane from a number of different biological sources, including manure, food industry waste, and even sewage treatment plants. That biomethane powers about 7,000 cars, a fleet of buses, and even a train. Earlier this month, the Swedish Minister of the Environment met with Governor Schwarzenegger's cabinet secretary, Terry Tamminen. They agreed to form a Swedish-California joint task force for biogas. Biomethane-powered cars operate like natural gas vehicles. There are currently about 30,000 natural gas vehicles in California already and over 300 fueling stations. Alan DeSalt says the gas from cow manure could simply hook into that existing network.
If you're looking at it from a consumer's point of view, you don't need to bring a shovel when you would need to fill up with this fuel. It's a gas that could be put in your car to run it just like a natural gas-powered vehicle.
DeSalt says California's dairy cows could produce the equivalent of more than 100 million gallons of gasoline a year. There are challenges. It could cost several million dollars just to build a pilot facility to see how the biogas cars would work. And then there's the problem of getting the methane from dairies to the consumers who need the fuel. Just how many cows would it take to power a single car?
To get enough to fill up your tank, it's probably around 6 or 7 cows, maybe a little more than that, for, let's say, a round trip with a full tank.
It's an option that's looking more attractive as gas prices climb higher. Cows supply a reliable, unending source of fuel, and California's dairy industry is growing. For the California Report, I'm Sasha Coca in Fresno.
My name is Terry Mattson, and I'm the owner-innkeeper of 10 Inverness Way Bed and Breakfast. Our inn is in a house that was built in 1904, so it's 101 years old. And our guest rooms have been named after trails that exist here in the park. We chose to name them after the trails to inspire guests to get outdoors and hike and explore the area. The Whitegate Trail is probably my favorite trail in the park, mainly because it's so underutilized. There's so much wildlife out there that's unaccustomed to humans that the experience is really wild and natural. The views out there are spectacular, looking towards Limantour Beach and Sunset Beach. And we also really encourage people to come and be quiet and finish that book that they started a month ago and have never been able to finish. So,
innkeeper Terry Mattson of Point Reyes National Seashore. Her bed and breakfast is called 10 Inverness Way.
Happy anniversary to the California Report.
For 10 years, the California Report has been bringing you the voices of the Golden State. This month, we're revisiting 4 stories we covered during our first year on the air to find out what's changed since then.
An unseasonably warm winter sun shines brightly in the eyes of hundreds of worshipers filing out a Sunday Mass at St. Patrick's Church in Watsonville. From the steps of the church, the edges of the green, rain-soaked Santa Cruz Mountains are visible. Nestled between that range and the Pacific Ocean, this fertile valley produces much of the country's fresh strawberries, lettuce, and broccoli. And until recently, much of that produce, especially the broccoli, was produced in Watsonville.
In early 1996, we visited the town of Watsonville as it lost a major employer. The NorCal Cristetti plant officially closed its doors, transferring some frozen food packers to another plant and leaving other employees wondering about their future. Reporter Peter John Schuler revisits the story and finds the region's economy is more complicated than a single plant closing.
With unemployment hovering around 15% lately, Watsonville remains a low-employment city. Those figures are rendered a little more slippery than in some areas because of the seasonal employment related to such industries as agriculture and tourism. But despite the decline of traditional food processing, the city gives an impression of economic vitality. Construction crews are busy on a downtown government building that has been put off for more than a decade. New housing has the city poised to become the largest in Santa Cruz County. And numerous mom-and-pop businesses have gobbled up what used to be vacant storefronts lining the city's main street. Just recently, the city received approval to annex 90 acres, much of it earmarked for light industry to provide new jobs for current residents. City Manager Carlos Palacios.
What we want to do here at the city is provide a positive economic climate to attract new jobs so that our folks, as they get trained, have the opportunity to compete.
Stephen Levy with the Center for the Continuing Study of the California Economy believes the loss of factories and companies is overstated in the public mind and is a distraction from the real issues the state needs to face. From a historic and economic point of view, he says, change is inevitable.
Passenger rail got supplanted by airlines. There used to be telephone operators and people used to use typewriters. There were cash registers and now there are computers. There's always change. There's always difficulty for people adapting to change. As an economist, I don't think it pays to fight change. I think it pays to invest in people to prepare them for change. But there'll always be some people who are left behind.
Levy and other economic watchdogs don't want to dismiss the real pain for those workers left behind, but they say many of those workers can be reabsorbed into the economy as new industries emerge or even as old industries transform themselves to meet emerging markets. Trish Kelly with the California Center for Regional Leadership says even in a field like food production, the lines between agriculture, food packaging, transportation, and processing are blurry. She says many California companies are combining those functions and introducing state-of-the-art procedures in order to compete in a world market.
They are going to higher value-added products, and there's more technology components in the production and the processing of their and the development of their products, and then that requires different workforce skills.
And Kelly says that with these advances, companies are much more interested in training and retaining high-skilled workers. Pride of San Juan in San Benito County is just one example of the trend in food producers reinventing themselves to meet the changing market pressures. Busy consumers are still looking for easy-to-prepare foods, but processed foods have fallen out of favor. Although much of Pride of San Juan's produce is still shipped in bulk, Vice President Joe Feldman says much of their business has changed to pre-washed, pre-wrapped artichokes and spinach that command a premium price in supermarkets.
What's driving the trend is time-starved consumers, convenience, packaging that is scannable in stores. Some people like product that's packaged. It's viewed as being a little more sanitary. With the wellness trend and the focus on eating fresh fruits and vegetables, it's very vibrant, alive, and well.
Feldman says this change has only emerged in recent years in response to consumer preference. For instance, he points to spinach, which has been the traditional domain of frozen and canned foods. He says consumption of fresh spinach has risen dramatically in the past few years, and California growers like Pride of San Juan have devoted more acreage to the crop than ever before. For the California Report, I'm Peter John Schuler.
Next week, we'll look back at President Clinton's 11th-hour bailout of L.A. County's public hospitals in 1995, the first of many since then. This month, we're marking the 10th anniversary of the California Report by asking listeners to share their personal top 10 lists of things that are special about California. The results are in, and the lists are as diverse as the state itself. Kim Graham of San Jose says she loves that her tomatoes are still producing in November. Desmond Ortega of Granada Hills gives the nod to Roxy's Deli in Westlake. And Leslie Wilson of Santa Barbara finds heaven on earth at Lassen Volcanic National Park. For San Diegan, David White, well, ballot initiatives are on the top. And for this Californian, the best of the state is in its aromas.
My name is Jeannie Killian from Albany, California. My top 10 memories of California are all scent memories from growing up in Visalia in the central San Joaquin Valley. Smells that I remember and love are 1. Walnut and oak trees all around town. 2. Knowing we were closer to Sequoia in Kings Canyon National Park because we could smell the pine trees as we drove up the mountains. 3. Raisins drying in the sun. 4. Peaches, plums, oranges, and apricots in my father's garden and along the road during our Sunday drives. 5. The smell of deer brush, sage, and manzanita in the chaparral of the foothills. 6. The smell of eucalyptus trees when we went on drives to the coast. 7. The scent of tomato plants as the tomatoes were being harvested. 8. Gilroy garlic. 9. Alfalfa and cornfields. 10. The yeasty smell of wineries.
What makes California special to you? It's not too late to weigh in with your own top 10 list. To submit your favorites and to read other lists we've received, go to californiareport.org. That's californiareport.org. California's official state tree is the redwood, but the sleek, languid palm tree is the more popular icon of the state's culture. There are nearly 3,000 varieties of palm trees dotting the landscape. Today, many of them are in danger from the effects of disease and age. Los Angeles Bureau Chief Alex Cohen reports.
In the city of Beverly Hills, there are more than 3,000 palm trees, and those are just the ones on city property. The man in charge of these trees is urban forester Ken Falsgraf. Standing on Beverly Drive, where palms line the streets for miles, Falsgraf says these are some of the oldest and tallest trees around.
In our city, we have a Canary Island date palm that is nearly 115 feet tall. We have a Mexican fan palm that is 122 feet tall. So they're hard to hide in the skyline.
The first palms in California were date palms, brought by Spanish missionaries in 1769. Here in Beverly Hills, Falsgraf says, people began planting palms in the 1880s, when the city was mostly a vast stretch of fields.
There were very few houses. The streets were put in, the sidewalks were put in, and the trees were planted. This was done in hopes that potential lot buyers would be able to envision the neighborhood of the future.
It worked. Palm trees in postcards, photos, and in the movies drew people to Southern California's balmy climate. It wasn't long before the palm tree became an integral part of the state's image. Not only are palms aesthetically pleasing, they're a solid species. Their pliable bark is incredibly strong and can stand up to harsh wind and weather. Whereas other trees have roots that can sprawl and break through sidewalks, Falsgraf says palm trees are well suited for planting in urban areas with limited space.
After 40 or 50 years passes and we start having problems with the hardwood trees, the palms continue to grow with no problems.
Well, not exactly no problems. Falsgraf says some palms have grown so high the city doesn't have equipment tall enough to prune them. And there's the problem of fusarium wilt. Fusarium wilt is a fungus that kills Canary Island date palms. Those are the trees with diamond-shaped bark and thick, full crowns. Fusarium is endemic to the soil in Southern California and has killed thousands of trees. Donald Hodel is a horticulture advisor for the UC system.
If it's there, it'll infect the palm. I liken it to the AIDS of palms because it's 100% fatal, but it's nearly 100% preventable through safe pruning practices.
In recent years, the spread of disease has been slowed by using a solution of bleach on tools in between pruning. But some palms are also just reaching the natural end of their lives. And replacing palm trees isn't cheap. In recent years, palms have become incredibly popular, especially at resorts in Las Vegas, and that's driven up the price. Leland Lai, president of the Palm Society of Southern California, has collected more than 300 species of palm at his Topanga Canyon home. There are palms with silvery gray, delicate leaves, stout palms without trunks. There are bushy, fern-like plants, ancient relatives of palm trees known as cycads. Standing by a fountain in his backyard, Lai says his favorite hobby isn't cheap.
The going rate for a date palm with maybe about 20 or 30 feet of trunk, maybe as much as about $7,000 to purchase.
And that's not including the cost of moving and planting a full-grown tree. The high price of palms has made city tree buyers turn to less expensive alternatives, and other species of trees with broader canopies may turn out to be a better alternative to help Southern California protect against air pollution. But Lai says, with hundreds of enthusiasts like him around, don't expect palms to disappear from the skyline anytime soon. For the California Report, I'm Alex Cohen in Los Angeles.
That's the California Report for this week, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller, with additional engineering from Danny Bringer, Paul Lancour, and Howard Gelman. Our webmaster is Alex Picaro. Sean Fagan and KQED Interactive designed our Top 10 web feature. Our interns are John Kane, Kasha Newman, and Allison Johnson. The producer is Stacey Bond. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. And this week, we say goodbye to Los Angeles Bureau Chief Alex Cohen. Alex started as an intern at KQED. Today, she's one of our most respected reporters and one of LA's toughest roller derby players. Alex, we're looking forward to hearing you on the airwaves from your new track in Austin. I'm Catherine Barron. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, committed to improving California's healthcare delivery and financing systems, on the web at chcf.org. The James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California, and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good. TIAA-CREF.org. Charitable Auto Resources, a full-service vehicle donation program management firm which helps nonprofit organizations increase their revenue. Online at charitableautoresources.com. And the Stewart Foundation, for coverage of important issues in public education.